This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I am talking to Bradford Morrow, who's a writer and also an editor. And today, and I've interviewed Bradford Morrow for Writer's Cast about one of his novels, but today we're talking about the magazine Conjunctions, which he is the editor of and the founder of. And this is part of a series that I've been doing, interviewing editors about their publishing programs of the last 30 or 40 years. So, Brad, it's nice to have you here. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, David. Glad to talk with you.
You know, I think this is really going to be fun. So Conjunctions, you founded, as I recall, and I'm pretty sure I just looked this up to be sure my memory did not betray me, you began it in 1981.
That's when it came out. I think the idea for it probably has, you know, I think in 79 or late 79, maybe 80, and it took a while for me to gather up the ideas and the resources and, you know, how this might possibly work. It took a year to do that. But the first issue came out in 1981.
And what was, in fact, the impulse behind founding Conjunctions? You know, you've started it and it's maintained this identity as being a home for, I don't want to say experimental, but certainly unconventional writing and writing that challenges structure, form, and content, and it's pretty but you're pretty broad. I mean, you're not, you know, you have not been limited in your literary territory. But what was it that initially spurred you to found the magazine?
Well, I felt there was a space for it. I felt there was an empty area. I was reading an empty field that could be, you know, populated by, you know, a different kind of gathering, a different kind of journal. And, you know, I was reading journals at the time and admired, you know, what Paris Review, had done, and, you know, other journals and so forth. But I wasn't seeing in any specific place all the writers that informed me, all the writers that I loved, both poetry and prose. You know, New Directions anthologies had been going on for quite a long time. I learned a lot from Lachlan's vision, obviously. And in fact, the first issue of Conjunctions was a fish drift in his honor. And I felt like that was a good place to start, was to look back before you can look forward. And I wasn't seeing in any single place writers who were informing my imagination and, you know, really stimulating me. And so I thought, well, I'll do a few issues. I had worked briefly as the editor of Blast 3, which John Martin, publisher of Black Star Press, you know, wanted to do. And he published Blast 1 and 2. This is Wyndham Lewis's old journal.
Yeah, right.
From the teens. I love that edgy quality and the audacious cover and the whole notion of, you know, up in your face a little bit and a little less. I agree with you. I don't care for the word experimental because, you know, the people that I publish, they don't usually blow up the laboratory. They're innovative. They get the job done. But, you know, they're out there. So that's the work I was reading. And I started with John and so forth, and I realized what he had in mind and what I had in mind were two different things. And he, God bless him, you know, he did Blast 3, and I bowed out. He had some ideas that I should publish, and I thought, if I'm going to do this, it can't be by committee. It's just got to be, let me go out and fail on my own. And so that's when I got the idea of Conjunctions. Kenneth Rexroth was a friend of mine way back then, and he knew Lachlan, and he asked Lachlan if he would mind if we did a first issue, you know, in his honor. And at that time, believe it or not, Lachlan was kind of eclipsed. He was a figure who wasn't really all that celebrated as much as he should be. I mean, that all changed in the 80s, and obviously by the time Jay, you know, passed away, he was a cultural hero, as he had always been. But so we put together this first issue, and I thought at the time, look, if I can do a few years, a couple of years, I don't want to do it quarterly because it would chew up, you know, too much time redesigning covers. And also, I wanted to have a project that had some heft to it, like a book-like anthology-like heft, so that, you know, you couldn't just set it aside and ignore it. So all these things kind of came together, and so we published the first few issues, and lo and behold, writers were coming to me saying, well, I like the aesthetic here. You're branching out. You're inclusive of writers who are at the fringes, you know, younger writers, also writers who are, you know, well-known. So it's a nice, you know, combination. And at the time, there were journals like Monty Mora, Elliot Weinberg, you know, Clayton Eshelman, Sulfur. These were more poetry-oriented, and the one thing about conjunctions was I wanted to equally weight poetry and prose. And I just happened to be equally devoted to both. And so we were publishing, you know, you had mentioned before, we were, you know, live on your podcast, we were talking about Robert Greeley. The very first poem I published, page one of Conjunctions 1, was a poem by Robert Greeley. So, you know, Greeley was someone who bridged all of the generations, and he meant so much to all of us. And it's kind of in, and, you know, he too had been a writer and a literary editor, and inspiring that way. So, you know, that's how I kind of got started. It was really, I had no master plan. I certainly had not thought that it would have gone on this long. But, you know, it developed and it grew, and that little niche I saw actually became a much larger thing. So that really I became devoted to publishing and republishing writers whose work I felt was ignored, writers who could not get into a place like, say, the New Yorker, or, you know, couldn't find a venue, you know, in a more mainstream publication. And we just grew exponentially. We went through a lot of publishers those first years, by the way. That's anybody who wants to start a literary journal and keep it going. Unless you've got some deep-pocketed, you know, visionary in your, you know, in your corner, you know, be prepared to go through publisher after publisher if you're going to keep it going. But you know, I persisted, and so it's remained.
Well, so and what I mean, there are a couple of things you did at the beginning that I think differentiate from many other magazines. For example, I think of lots of the magazines of the 60s and 70s as starting small and kind of developing in some cases, and not usually even lasting anywhere near as long as Conjunctions has lasted. But I think you started with a much more fully formed vision of self than a lot of the more fugitive magazines that were around then and were doing, you know, kind of, you know, not to say that's not equally important, but just that their physical vision was much, much smaller when they started, and sometimes they grew and sometimes they didn't. But you really had a strong vision at the beginning that you wanted to do serious, as you said, the books would, you know, the magazine was almost like, was a book. I mean, it was book length. It had the heft. Also, you designed very carefully and had, you know, used quality typesetting, which, you know, is different from a lot of Mimeo magazines that were doing, you know, just Selectric typewriter typesetting. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what I presume that was purposeful when you started, but it's also much more expensive to do that. And I'm just curious, how did you, in fact, finance the magazine in those early years? What was who was the publisher behind you, you know, in terms of finance and business?
Well, there are a few or a couple of questions in here that are really interesting to me that you're bringing up. One is, you know, in retrospect, I would never have known this in my late 20s when I started conjunctions, but, you know, I've always had a novelist's approach to things. I just think novelistically, and, you know, I published a few books of poetry, but I'm not really a poet. I like the lyricism of language, and I like, you know, a prose fiction that kind of sings and so forth. It has formal innovations to it, and you know, accounts for the musicality of whatever language it's being written in. But at the end of the day, I think narratively, you know, long scale, large. And so I'd never been kind of a mimeograph guy. I both recognize and admire very much the politics behind that kind of publishing from the 60s and so forth, where it was like, you know, Barney Rossett is one of my great heroes, and he didn't do mimeograph stuff, but Evergreen Review was cool in design. You know, it was meant to pack a punch. And I mentioned Lachlan's New Directions anthologies. But, you know, Evergreen Review is also like something really that I modeled conjunctions on. Anyway, point being, I felt the mimeograph stuff, it's really more gauged toward poetry, different kind of political expression. It's like, okay, you know, we need to get this stuff out quickly because it's urgent. And what I felt was, with conjunctions, a different kind of urgency. And maybe it's a novelist's urgency, you know, which is like, okay, we want to give you something where you really have to digest this thing. There's a lot of narrative. And even the way the issues are put together, David, looking back, it's a very careful narrative that goes into putting together an issue. Like, what corresponds to what? You can have a poem sitting next to a prose piece, and they may not look... The authors might have hated each other, but their pieces somehow, you know, fit together in such a way that it created a kind of a book. So that was the impulse to doing, you know, longer, heftier issues. Now, that financing... Oh, God, I was a babe in the woods. This is one of those things I'm like, well, okay, well, if it costs this much to typeset it and get this paper for that amount and you ship it out and you get so many subscribers, well, you're break even. I mean, I never looked to make a dollar and, you know, off this project. And anybody who enters into a literary journal publication or who's looking to make a buck, we're gonna make a lot of money off this thing. Well, good luck. I mean, people have, but that was not my experience. I financed the first three issues on my own, and I lost my shirt. And the checkered history of conjunctions vis-a-vis financing it and publishing it in the early years is a real story. It's a novel unto itself. Lachlan saw that I was about to go under. He put me in touch with a gentleman named Robert McKinney, who had been like the ambassador to Switzerland or something. He was some great multi-zillionaire and very odd and interesting man, and owned newspapers and always fancied himself interested in publishing. And he published a couple of issues. I think Jay, you know, Lachlan kind of talked him into it, and he found me intriguing, like, who's this odd duck who's willing to do this? And then he submitted to me some sonnets of his own for me to publish, and I thought, oh, God, here we go. This story just has to be now, and he sent me a sheaf of sonnets. You know, McKinney was a good man, a very good man, but he was not a good... Maybe he was even a good writer of sonnets, but I was not publishing sonnets in conjunction. Now, unless it was somebody who was trying to bust up the you know, the 14-line sonnet note, which I have published. I mean, if he came in with some John Berryman-type stuff, that would be something. But these were, like, romantic sonnets. And I called Lachlan and I said, this seems like a quid pro quo here. I either publish these things or he's going to dump me. And Lachlan said, publish them, everybody will understand.
That is great.
Well, it was good advice, which I didn't take.
Right.
And so I told my publisher, like, man, I'll help you get these published elsewhere. And I won't name the places on this podcast where, like, I probably could have got him published elsewhere, but he wanted it in conjunction with Ralph, and then he dumped me when I said no. He said, you're the most intransigent young man I've ever met. That's a quote. And I thought, well, that's a compliment, but now I'm $10,000 in debt for the new issue. This is conjunction 6. And a bunch of friends, you know, put together the money. We did some fundraising, and we got the issue out. And then David Godin came along and said, well, I'll publish you for a while. So Godin did it, bless his heart. He never made a penny off it. Then an editor at Collier named John Glusman, who's a very big-time editor now. John's still and a writer. John took it on. Through with them for a while, and then I got a letter from them saying we just can't keep doing this anymore. And then I got a call from Leon Bockstein at Bard College. And Leon said, I hear good things about you. Would you like to come up and talk? And I said, sure, I would like to. This is about conjunctions 14. And we were again going to go under. And I met with Bockstein and with the folks at Bard, and this has been the happiest marriage since conjunctions 15. They've been our publisher, wonderful publisher, supportive. I've never had one call from anybody saying, "Well, would you mind publishing, Professor So and So? Would you mind doing this? Would you mind doing that?" They've been the most elegant, respectful, supportive. I honestly can't come up with enough positive adjectives to describe the relationship. So I worked hard, you know, to get to that point. That took me 7 years, you know, of you know, stumbling, getting back up, stumbling, getting back up, getting thrown out, getting back up. And now we've got this wonderful home at Bard College. And, you know, it's been a great, great run since then.
So does Bard also, I mean, aside from finance, does Bard provide, I presume Bard provides you with some other forms of assistance? Do you get students who work on the magazine? Is that part of the project?
Oh, yes. I mean, the students at Bard, first of all, in my experience, I've taught it. You know, I've taught at Princeton, I've taught at Columbia, I've taught elsewhere. The students at Bard are very special people. And over the years, it must be run into the dozens of students who've been editorial assistants. You know, there are two offices, one here in New York, where we do the actual editing of the journal, but a business office up at Bard also, where the journal is, you know, overseen at that end. And currently, my managing editor, Michaela Morissette, she was a student of mine at Bard, I think a little over 10 years ago. And she's a wonderful writer. She went on to get an MFA from Brown. But now she is my managing editor, one of my top you know, senior editors here, a couple of them, J.W. McCormick, Jedediah Berry, they're all former students of mine at Bard. And it's not strictly Bard. I mean, there's a woman working for us who's doing grad school at Columbia. We've had people from, you know, Brown and, Princeton, Harvard, the New School, kind of you name it. But there's always been a constant fund of amazing Bard kids who've worked at the Journal over the years, and the, you know, that's just been a huge bonus and a huge plus.
And does, I mean, just to get into the nuts and bolts a little bit, does Bard then, they take care of things like going and getting, applying for grants, and they handle the finances related to subscriptions and distribution and all that stuff. So that's all, is that all off your shoulders, or do you participate in that as well?
Oh, no, I'm very involved with that. You know, you can, you know, my primary job is to get a conjunction sent to. We also have developed over the last 10 years, we've developed a internet, you know, e-zine, as it were, called Web Conjunction. So I publish 52 writers a year, featuring them, you know, one per week. So it's like more than just the two journals that, you know, whatever, 750 pages for the two of them, but it's, you know, this web scene too. They have folks who help with Michaela, and sort of everybody works together to get grants, and we can always use more grants. Anybody listening, we can always use the help. Nobody should think that a literary journal ever is a financial winning situation, but you know, Bard has been terrific, and I might as well announce on your podcast that we are doing something very interesting that'll launch in January, which is we've just struck a deal, something I've been working on for over a year, with the ebook publisher Open Road Media, which is a wonderful ebook publisher. They have, I think, like 8 of my books available as ebooks. I was talking with Jane Friedman and people at Open Road, and we've figured out a way to start bringing out conjunctions as an ebook. And, you know, so we'll be available in that, you know, in that context for starting in January.
I think that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
I think I was going to, you know, ask you about the web conjunctions as well, and just curious to know, when did you start that? And it looks like a huge amount of work, and to add on top of editing the journal.
You know what it is for me? It is more work, yeah, sure. But for me, it means 52 times that I don't, that a piece that I like a lot doesn't really fit with the theme we're working on for an issue is one that I don't have to reject. It's something I can actually publish and get behind, which is a blessing, believe me. I mean, I would so much rather write, I'm delighted to take your piece for Web Conjunctions. We'll feature you for a week in October or, you know, April. Can't wait to, you know, glad to have you on board. Then, you know, I regret, you know, to say that I just love this work, but it won't fit with our current theme. And you know what I mean, David? It's just, it's another opportunity to do what I've been doing all these years, which is, you know, help people get their work out there before an audience who I think would like to read it. So, yeah, there's more work, but in a certain way, you know, in another way, it's less work, because it's so much easier for me to get something in the pipeline with the web conjunctions. And, you know, we have, again, up at Bard, Michaela and others, they do the coding. We have a lot of folks who volunteer. You know, it's, conjunctions is a large, it's pretty large, conglomerate of writers. I mean, everybody involved, almost to a person, with the exception of our typesetter, I guess, and maybe a couple other people, are all writers. They're aspiring writers, they're accomplished writers, they're you know, writers who volunteer their time, but we're all a bunch of writers. And so for us to be able to publish something by somebody is far better than to say no. Especially if it has to do with, especially if it has simply to do with, you know, a theme that, you know, that happens not to fit what they sent us at that time.
Right, now, and it makes sense that it's, you know, the idea behind what you're doing is to make work available. It's to curate and present, and I think, you know, obviously every opportunity you get to do that is a plus. You know, it's furthering the impulse that you started with, which is to present work that you feel is important. So I think that makes sense.
Well, you know what else? Sometimes, a couple of things. It used to be that web conjunctions was kind of a proving ground, as it were. You publish somebody who's young, and then I keep following their work, and then they wind up at the print journal, and that was sort of like maybe, you know, a trend or something, like a progression, if you will. But now it's not that way at all. It's they're just different scenarios. I mean, we've now published writers who are incredibly well known. Valerie Martin had never published a lover work, you know, Orange Prize winner. She had never published on the internet before, and she sent me a novella. Just, I loved it to death, but it didn't fit in what we were doing. And she thought about it for a while. She said, okay, let's do it. So I did it as a two-part thing. And now you can go on web conjunctions and you'll find like a Ray Armantrout, or, you know, someone who's a National Book Award winner next to people who are finding their first, you know, appearance in quote-unquote print. So I really have enjoyed watching the development of that part of the whole publishing program. And again, there's no money involved there. We're about also to launch a new website about the same time as the ebook publication, you know, program begins. So, you know, it's David, with no advertising, nothing but, you know, virtual word of mouth, we've had upwards of 700,000 hits on web conjunctions. I mean, it's a presence, I mean, in its way.
Oh, that's significant. I think it is. I mean, that's one of the advantages, obviously, of digital publishing, that it removes the overhead cost of, you know, print and distribution. Not to say that, you know, all things should switch to digital, but there are certain kinds of publishing that really benefit from the reduction in overhead costs. You know, it makes a plus. There's also, as you were indicating, you can do it every week. You can the flow of work from thought concept to publication can be much quicker. So
it's like to have both, you know, to have, you know, a print issue coming out every spring, every fall, arranged around some interesting thematic notion, you know, idea. And to have weekly, you know, what I suppose you want to think back to Mimeo. Like, you know, digital Mimeo. Like, you know, every week we get to, like, throw out a digital Mimeo. And here's our author of the week. And, like, we believe in this person. So here it is, quick. And everything, by the way, is treated with the same respect as in the print issue. In other words, everything is copy-edited. All the authors have proofs to read and to approve before it ever goes up live online. So, you know, it's all done with the same kind of, you know, like I said, respect, professional, you know, attitude toward the work.
Yeah, I think that's...
There's no differentiation between, you know, what we do online and what we do in the print journal.
Right. No, I think that's important. That's a... You know, that it's speedier, but you're not short shrifting the editorial side.
Right.
You just don't have to send it to a printer. And plus, that actually leads me to another question I meant to ask you earlier about the magazine, and that is, what is your process for selecting the theme for each issue? And has that changed significantly or meaningfully over the years from when you first started? Do you find, I mean, is it different for you now in terms of process?
The only difference now is that, one wants not to repeat oneself. So I have to, if I get this idea, like, oh, what about this or that? And then I have to think, well, did I already do that?
Right, or something close to, so
Or did it
close.
something close to
Yeah,
that?
yeah.
Or if I did do that, is that worth revisiting in such a way that I could bring new light on whatever the subject was? So, I mean, that's the only difference. I mean, a lot of this just comes from a lot of these ideas either hatch them in the middle of the night, I wake up with this idea just like I do as a writer, or I'll be talking with a friend about something and, oh, well, that's kind of an interesting idea. And sometimes if I have not come up with an idea on my own, I'll just throw it out to my, wonderful crew, say, what do you guys think? What's in your head? And then they'll throw back a bunch of interesting ideas, which may generate yet another idea. So it's mostly I come up with these on my own, but also there's a great collaborative element from time to time. And even if I do find the idea, what's the title going to be? How do you pitch it? What's it? How do we describe it? Because we can say, and the spring issue is going to be on exile, but like, what is exile exactly? I mean, is it only political, or is it existential, or is there some kind of, can you be exiled within the precincts of your own home? Well, of course. So, the ideas also develop while we're actually putting the issue together. Somebody will come up with something, and I'll say, oh, hadn't thought of that facet of the argument. Well, why don't we just open up that whole other direction? Let's go over there too. A couple of times, I didn't even have an idea for an issue, and a piece came in, and I thought, okay, I'm going to just make an issue. I love this work so much. I'll build an issue around what they're doing. That happened once with a John Barth novella that he sent me. And I thought, well, this sure doesn't work in what I'm doing, but this is an amazing novella. And it had to do with being on the road, and it was a kind of travel, and it was a journey involved. And so I put together an issue about, journeying, being on the road, based on Jack's, novella. There was a woman named Karen Hayes, who you may not have heard of. Everybody should know her work. Everybody listening, run out and find something by Karen Hayes. She's a genius, and she sent me this piece about mathematics, about, I could not reduce it to anything. It's such a work of almost like Guy Davenport, polymathic integrity and investigation, and she seems to know about everything, geology, you name it. But it had a kind of fundamental thread that went through it about her children, her two boys, one of whom had lost his first pet. I forget what the pet was. We'll call it a turtle or something. It might have been a turtle. And I thought, this is just too astonishing. And she's never been published before, or, very little. Nobody's heard of her. I'm going to just build the whole issue around family, because that's the only way I can fit this piece into a context so I can publish it. And so the Kim issue of Conjunctions, which is Conjunctions, I was somewhere, 57. I literally built based on my love of this relatively unknown writer's 40 or 50 page essay. So you never know, David. It can come from any different direction.
No, I think that's actually, it's great to hear that, because I think it reflects the organicism of of the process, you know, that you, it, you know, it sort of demonstrates that it's not a fully structured set of rules that you have to impose, and that the system that you've developed is kind of quirky. And now
quirky is a great word. I want consensus to remain quirky, because if it's not going to be quirky or idiosyncratic or a little bit kind of, well, then it's going to get formulaic, and then it's going to be tiresome.
Right, and that's always, and I think for any magazine or any enterprise that's gone on as long as yours has done, to be able to resist being boxed up and formalized is very challenging. I think you've really achieved that. You know, I can look back at, I mean, I obviously don't know them as well as you do, but if I look back on a lot of those issues that I've read over the years, I know that there's a conjunction's identity. I think there's an ethos that's at work. It may have changed over time, but I think it's a recognizable aesthetic. But it does not feel formulaic at all. So you've stayed away from, you know, falling into that trap, which I think is, I mean, that's, it's admirable, but it's also, I mean, it's very hard to do.
Well, again, I just go back to being, I don't know, I don't know exactly how this, I managed to do that, but if I got bored with it, if I felt, this is it, we're done, I'm now making up themes because to keep the damn
right
train rolling down those tracks, why then, you know, I would hope I would have the integrity and just common sense to say, oh, okay, I think we're done here. I think I'm done here anyway.
Well, that actually leads to a really interesting question, and that's the one about succession. In a, you know, here's an enterprise. You're not like a theater where there's this a building and a crew. And I mean, in some ways, you are. You could be like the Joe Papp, right? You're the Joe Papp. He's the public. You're the your conjunctions. But what happens next? You know, like at some point, you will decide either, as you just said, I've done what I can do. It's time for somebody else. Or you can say, I've done what I can do. It's time to shut it down. So which is it? Which would you like to see happen? Do you want to see it continue in the hands of somebody else? Or would you rather say it ends when I end it?
Will you forgive me if I don't know the answer to that question?
Absolutely, of course.
I simply don't know the answer. You know, I hear something weird as I'm looking out the window toward 9th Street, and if you turn, I'm on University and Kent, you turn on 9th Street, you go down half a block, that's where Joseph Papp used to live. There's like a brass plaque in front of the building. You bring a Papp, and I think, oh, God, there, we're talking brass plates. Now,
sorry.
I don't know the answer to that question. What I would want to do, obviously, is to take care of everybody. I would want to take care of the project. I would want to make sure that it's, you know, this gets tricky, this part of the conversation, because I've been around long enough now, unbelievably to me, that I've watched people screw this part of their project up big time. You know, I've seen, but I just am not going to name a name because it just wouldn't be helpful to what let's keep it just like theoretical. To watch people hand it over to people who didn't know what they're doing, or people just like, and watch them make a mess of it, and just in a way, and then I watched people end it. And I know with their own tenure, and that's it, we're done. And have thought to myself, well, I wonder if there wasn't a way for them to continue it, but maybe reinvent it, or so I'm in a place, you can hear the enthusiasm in my voice as I talk about conjunctions, which is sort of amazing to me. I mean, I love this thing. So I'm, and also, by the way, David, I've had, you know, co-editors over the years. I mean, it's really been a joy. People like Quincy Troop and Peter Straub and, oh, Martin Bellin and Howard Norman and,
yeah,
recently,
Benjamin
Hale, some great,
great.
You know, John Guerra, I let him do an issue. I asked him to do an issue. He graciously did a new American Theater issue. Robert Antoni helped me do a Caribbean issue. I mean, just on and on. So I've been very fortunate in inviting other people in. And how Succession just, I guess at this moment, really isn't in my head. But it's something I have to very carefully figure out, you know, going forward, how that might work.
Well, and I didn't mean to put you on the spot in any negative way. It occurred to me as a question, but I can see that it's also sort of one that you might not know the answer to, or might not want to, not be able to answer prospectively. You know, you might just have to know when the time comes.
Well, I could answer it two ways. I could say, yeah, you know, I did it. Let's shut it down. Whatever. Anything else after that would be. Or I could say, well, let's find somebody who, or a couple of people who could. I just don't know. Right now, I'm vigorously involved with it, and you know, I'm not picking coffins yet, or something. that's actually very ugly. I'm sorry.
I
don't know the answer to the question. I just don't.
Well, but I think it's
a damn great question, and it's the question I'm going to have to answer at some point. So.
Right, but I think it does also, it reflects a little bit the difference between a literary magazine and, let's say, a theater, where at least you have this option in a different way. So, you know, because it is not so much, it's not about a building, it's much more about a kind of impulse. You know, then the question is, can the impulse be continued? And that's something that you'll have to find out at a later time. But while you're still, you know, at this point, obviously, the other thing that's clear is this is not what you're thinking about today. You know, you're still in it. So the future is still a different thing.
Yeah, I just accepted an amazing poem this morning by a wonderful New Mexican poet. And at the same time, you know, got some pages on my new novel that's coming out next fall with Grove Atlantic, with, you know, the Mysterious Press imprint. So I'm, you know, it's like, well, would you ever consider stopping writing? You know, well, it's just neither of those things, and it's been my kind of twin pistons, if you will, like writing and editing, and a book, a journal. And people have asked me in the past, editing conjunctions kind of make your life as a novelist a misery, because you're always, you know, having to do this or that. But, you know, it's not true. They both inform each other. Each of them is sort of two halves of a whole for me personally. And I gain energy from the one. I gain energy from the other. When I'm working on a novel, I get an idea like, oh, God, maybe we can do that. But there's an idea for an issue. Or I'll be doing an issue, and I'm like, there's an idea, there's a word that I could put in the book. I mean, it works mostly, they're actually very separate enterprises, but when I can't do the one, I'll do the other. And so for me, it's been a life. And you know, David, when I first got started, going back to your first question, and I thought about this, well, I wanted to be a writer. But could I edit a journal too? And I thought, well, you know, all my heroes were editors of literary journals going way back. And, you know, we mentioned Wyndham Lewis, but, you know, everybody from Marion Moore, Fort Madox Ford, G.S. Eliot, even Ezra Pound, you know, Creeley, we brought up Creeley before. All these people who were writers who I really respect and admire, you know, they helped out. They got themselves involved in being in a partnership with their literary community, with their, you know, period of time. And so it's not only just sitting home writing your book, you can do both. Now, it doesn't work for every writer. Some writers just would never want to be involved in helping other writers, you know, it doesn't take a damn thing away from them. They do what they do. That's good by me. But this has worked out for me personally, that teaching, writing, editing, the whole, you know, vibrant kind of honeycomb of what I do has been very energizing, ultimately. Don't think for a moment it hasn't been depressing at times, and like, how the hell can I keep going? This is all too much. Get over my head. But it hasn't proved to be that way, so I just keep going.
Well, I think it is. There is a certain kind of writer, editor, being as you are. I think you know that there's something about it. It's a social impulse. I think it's also a literary impulse that I really think needs to hasn't been explored fully as in this way, that the impulse to write and also to share the work of the writers whose work you really feel is important. That's what you're reflecting, you know, that it's the community is one that's that you're creating, and is a one of sharing, and of it's a kind of impresario role in a way, you know, of presenting. That's the publishing role, you know, of serving a community, but also of creating a community by making those efforts to reach out and to connect. To connect people to work, to connect work to people. And, you know, not, as you said, not every writer can do that, but I think there's an impulse that you share that with the people that you talked about as your precursors, and, you know, there are some others as well, that I think, you know, I think it's a, I don't know whether it's, I don't know whether it's unique, but it's certainly singular. To a certain kind of person.
Yeah, and I think, I wonder if the word impresario might not be edited and replaced with the word, you know, kind of familial. Because I, you know, writing is a very, as every one of your listeners, every one of our mutual friends knows who's a writer, you know, it's a solitary situation. You're sitting there and you're working, and the quieter it is, probably the better. And the more alone you are, the more full you are of, more fulfilled you are. No, more full you are of what you're trying to accomplish on the page. You got a better chance at getting on the page that line, that sentence, those few words that are going to convey what that narrative gesture is going to be at that moment. So to have that solitary, you know, role as a writer, and at the same time have a family of other writers, and not to mention readers, who you get to commune with on the non-writing hours. Oh, that's just a huge blessing. I mean, it's what a full life. Robert Cooper once asked me at the Brown University, there was a conference, and I forget what the occasion was. But Cooper asked me, like, how do you do those two roles? How does it work? And he asked it a really typical Robert Cooper kind of way. It was very pointed, very sharply phrased, and there was like really good question, like, how do you do it? Well, how does that work? And off the top of my head, I came up with this image. I said, well, you know, I used to be a jazz musician, which I did. And I said, you know, sometimes, you know, you comp behind the others while they're soloing. And, you know, you listen to them very carefully, and you, like, make sure you get the chords behind them that'll structure things in such a way that, you know, you're really helping advance their improvisation. And then other times you do your own solos, and you improv, and they support you. And I remember the look at Cooper gave me kind of a nodding smile. I thought, that was a good answer. You know, if Cooper likes it, it works for me. But also, it was actually sort of the truth. I was like, you know, writing the way I do it anyway has a kind of a jazz element, a musical element. And there's improv, you know, and you brought up Joseph Papp. I'm not as you know, versed in the theater. I can talk about jazz, though. And so, you know, sometimes you comp behind the others and you support them. then it's your turn to solo, and you hope you do a really good solo, and you improv on top of what they're doing. And you really have to understand that this is you're just part of you're another wave coming to shore. This is a huge, you're part of a big, long, historical event that, you know, cascades from the Elizabethans to the, you know, to the 18th century, the Jonathan Swift, to, you know, then the Victorians, and then, you know, it's just to the, you know, the modernists, and then the postmodernists, and who knows what comes next. And it's just, it's all part of a huge community, much bigger than any literary journal or any kind of era. Bigger than, you know, the internet or mimeograph or, you know, monotype volumes from the, you know, Incunabula. It's just, it's a huge, huge, long process of trying to define ourselves through literature. And I'm just so honored to play a small part in all that.
Oh, that's, you know what, you've just really described it perfectly. I think that's where we should close, because I can't think of a more eloquent way for this podcast to end. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, David.
It's been great talking to you, Bradford. This is David Wilk. I've been interviewing Bradford Morrow, editor and founder of Conjunctions Magazine. This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. Thanks so much.